From RTE Radio, I'm Niall O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
This year's song was terrible. Ollie Alexander couldn't hit a note. The staging was revolting, out of order. Disaster, really. Go back to acting. You're very good at that.
This woman was there for 20 minutes, very drunk and slapping and grinding against the portal before the Gardaí stepped in.
We joked when we were kids, Jack did the cooking and I did the chopping.
Right.
Naturally, he delegated the worst jobs to me as his little brother.
Coming up on this manky Monday edition of Playback Daily, the Eurovision that was not for everyone. Dubliners disgrace themselves across the space-time continuum. And you'll believe a salad can fly. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that has never been to the junction of O'Connell Street and North Earl Street. Honest. Let's begin the show today with Oliver Callan musing on, who else? Bruce Springsteen, who played in Kilkenny last night. Accompanied, of course, by his heart-stopping, pants-dropping, love-making, earth-quaking, Viagra-taking E Street Band.
But it was very interesting. Bruce Springsteen, he's known for his three-hour sets, but he came on at 5 p.m. in Nolan Park in the centre of Kilkenny City, and 2 hours before he was due on. And he played This Hardland and then disappeared again and didn't come back till 7 p.m. for his three-hour set. The Examiner this morning says, garden parties sprung up in houses all around the stadium, some playing Springsteen's greatest hits and others took turns on karaoke machines, murdering a few classics, as they want to do. So he starts at 7 p.m. in a very emotional way, an unexpected way, a familiar accordion strain echoed across the stadium. Bruce Springsteen kicked off a sunny night in Kilkenny with a rainy night in Soho. Here's a little clip. Just a beautiful way to open. Tears fell in Nolan Park, but not a drop of rain. Of course, a tribute to Shane McGowan, who died late last year. And Springsteen, when he was here last in Ireland, he went to visit Shane McGowan in hospital and was a great friend. So lovely, just a nice way to start things off. Bruce gets it all so right. His set list changes from place to place, town to town already after Belfast, now in Kilkenny, two different sets. So good morning to you in Kilkenny this morning.
The boss is truly the gift that keeps on giving. But it's Monday, so Oliver will want to check in on sporting matters from the weekend.
Loads of sport, tons of it all across, all codes, all weekend, non-stop. The Ulster final, were you watching it? It has saved the football championship. Nobody expected this to be so entertaining. Armagh versus Donegal. We expected it to be defensive. It was. But the referee was whistle shy, mercifully, and so it flowed gorgeously like a river breaking through a desert. Armagh, they had it won in normal time, 4 points up, but Jim McGuinness, his holy magic just woke up Donegal and they finished level at 15 points apiece to create the extra time, and we were thrilled, those of us watching it. We wanted more of this and they gave it more. 10 points scored in extra time, 5 apiece. We had thunder, lightning, the TV signal went down at one stage, there were skids, the sun came out, the sun went back out, there were very few frees, there were very few wides. It was bloody deadly, and sadly it had to end with penalties. It's just not how Ulster or nearly any provincial title should be decided, but that's what happened. Remarkably, all the first 10 penalties were scored and it went to sudden death, and then Donegal keeper saved it, and there you go. Jim McGuinness is a wizard, because Donegal were ragged last year. They had a disastrous year, relegated to Division 2, lost, crashed out of the championship in Ulster and in the qualifiers, and then he comes back in his second coming and they've got another Ulster title. It's unbelievable. He's a witch, Jim McGuinness. Something mysterious going on indeed. In Leinster, it was the same old story. Dublin won, but I'd say a great day out for Louth. There was Louth flags fluttering all across the county over the weekend, and they got to their second provincial final in a row. It put up a good fight, even got a consolation goal towards the end, but Dublin were the Leinster champions for the 14th consecutive year. In fact, they've won 19 out of the last 20 Leinster titles. They're the only little blip is Meath in 2010, which Louth fans will remember because they were robbed robbed that day when Meath literally carried the ball across the goal line and Louth should have won their first Leinster title since the 50s, but it wasn't to be. And they go into the group thing now, the round robin system where there's going to be 12 matches to eliminate only four teams. So Kerry, Monaghan, Meath and Louth will be all together. There's some good matches in there and Louth will be expected to be still standing after it's the top three that qualify for the knockout stages. But the hurling.
Tell us about the hurling, Oliver.
The hurling was wondrous again. Cork versus Limerick. You'd have to see it to believe it, but unfortunately you couldn't see it because it was held to ransom there behind the GAA Go paywall. This is the annual row that we're having now. There was unexpected condemnation actually from the Taoiseach on Friday about GAA Go, and then a Fianna Fáil minister yesterday, along with Labour and Sinn Féin. They said it was hurting the popularity of hurling. I mean, the GAA, do they not understand at this stage that Colchis hate paying for things? Except for green diesel and Nathan Carter tickets. That's it. Maybe a scratch card here and there. That's it. We don't want to be paying €12 for one match. You get a month of streaming elsewhere for that. There is a 3-for-2 matches offer for €24, I saw. Or €79 if you want to see every match that's behind the GAA Go paywall. I actually did it last year, and the most annoying thing was that you couldn't get to watch the match in full a couple of days later or a week later, even though you'd paid for it. That drove me mad. It would be interesting to see the audience figures for GAA Go at the weekend. We'll put in a request and see if they'll offer them, because there's no doubt Cork Kilkenny, with all the people texting each other, it would have been a huge television audience if it were free. But we move along.
The poor hurling, hurt by the GAA Go controversy. But I'm not sure why it's controversial. I mean, it's been going on for years, hasn't it? Have people only just noticed? Anyway, away from the sporting arena, the big story of the weekend was...
Eurovision. Oh my God. Completely and utterly overshadowed and ruined, really, by the controversy over Israel's involvement. Several television jurors withdrew on the day of the show. Then you had the chaos over the Netherlands being disqualified. People here, of course, were hoping for a boycott. Instead, Irish viewers give Israel 10 points. This is the telecast votes. This is the public vote. You have to pay to vote. 60 cent per vote. You could vote 20 times. Some people did. The RTE jury, meanwhile, gave 0 points, nul point, to Israel. But across Europe, Israel finished second in that popular vote and they got 12 points from 15 countries, more than anybody else, even though Croatia came first, just ahead of Israel, in the popular vote. And then after the show, I was reading the Sunday Times Eurovision fan clubs. We were speaking to Eurovision fan club here on Friday. They clashed verbally with the Israel Eurovision fan club. Bambi Thug complained that they were followed around in the VIP section by the Israeli Eurovision fan club, who were berating Ireland for everything that's been going on in the last while. Ireland, it's interesting actually, in such a powerful country like Israel, that they've even noticed that Ireland has become vociferously, government-wise and public-wise, anti-Israeli over what's happened in Gaza. But Bambi Thug has complained that warnings about her song on Israeli television broke the rules, and there's widespread coverage, particularly in the British press, even today. The Daily Telegraph giving prominence on page 5 and all the various F-words that Bambi has thrown at the EBU. Graham Norton also made a similar warning to BBC viewers, but there's been no complaint in his direction. He issued a nightmare warning to children ahead of Ireland's demonic diva, so says The Guardian newspaper. There was so much booing. Fans in the arena booed the Israeli performance. They booed the EBU guy who came up in the suit twice. They booed when Germany voted for Israel. Heard directly from someone inside the arena who said the booing was so loud that they could barely hear the Israel song at all, which was different to the television experience. So it was a night with edge, far too much edge, really, for a fun song and no pants competition. But the show, as a programme, as an entertainment show, it sort of fell apart when ABBA didn't bother turning up, even though the 50th anniversary was the main reason the TV juries screwed Finland last year. Remember that? And that gave the interval period, I think, a really flat, anticlimactic air. And then that was followed by an hour of extremely boring results with zero drama because Switzerland had it won from the off. But the main thing for us to remember is Bambi Thug gave Ireland our best performance at Eurovision by some distance since we won it 28 years ago, 1996. But a nightmare weekend for the EBU with tons of criticism and unhappiness from all corners, not least the Netherlands. The entry was banned after allegations of inappropriate behaviour. Oh my God. There was so much unpleasantness. And to sort of highlight the sense of disaster, Nemo of Switzerland, who won for Switzerland for the first time since Celine Dion in the 80s, Nemo broke the winner's trophy during the celebration performance at the end of the night. He broke the code and the trophy. It emerged Nemo also managed to break their thumb in that move that broke the crystal thing and cut themselves with the broken glass. Utter chaos. I doubt they will ever give a crystal piece of glass to a winner just before they're about to jump around the stage singing the winning song ever again. So it'll be another change where we'll give them an acrylic one and then this real glass one. That would make sense. The UK's entry, Alexandra, got 0 votes from the public. 37 countries, 0. And it's not because of Brexit or anti-British sentiment, which the UK press has been claiming ever since. Rubbish. Only because 2 years ago, Sam Ryder finished second for the UK with that brilliant song, Spaceman. This year's song was terrible. Ollie Alexander couldn't hit a note. The staging was revolting, out of order. Disaster, really. Go back to acting. You're very good at that. All right. Good Lord.
Good Lord is one phrase for it, all right. The Eurovision. Can't live with it. Pass the nuts, Woody. Let's put a pin in the Oliver Callan morning musings there and move on with our lives. New legislation to raise the legal smoking age to 21 is up for cabinet approval this week. Claire Byrne was joined this morning by Professor Des Cox, consultant in paediatric respiratory medicine at CHI Crumlin, to talk about what it means for Ireland's smoking habits.
The bottom line is this measure would make it more difficult for teenagers to buy cigarettes and would make it access more difficult for 18 to 21 year olds as well. It also will delay the age of initiation of smokers, which is really important because research shows us that if you can delay the age of initiation of young people smoking, it will lessen the harms of tobacco smoking down the line mm-hmm. and make them less likely to become regular smokers. And the other issue, as you mentioned there, is the denormalizing behavior. So it just absolutely puts it out there that it's not it's not legal to smoke at this age, and because it's a harmful measure. And then we all know that if tobacco products came to the market nowadays, it wouldn't be legalized. It'd be banned outright because of the dangers. 1 in 2 people die because of tobacco smoking. So it's not something that anyone really should be taking up.
Does it work though? Raising the age to 21. Like, what impact is it likely to have? Do you think?
Yeah. So look, I mean, the bottom line is most people start smoking below the age of 18. But if you take the growing up in Ireland study, smoking rates double between the ages of 17 to 20. So this is a real crucial age group to tackle. Getting people, if you ever talk to somebody who smokes, they all always say, look, oh gosh, I wish I should never started. So you're trying to get them at the very beginning. So where this has been introduced is that the data would mainly be coming out of the US. And certainly one study from Massachusetts where it was first introduced, the smoking rates in the 15 to 18 year old dropped by 50%. And they saw like a significant drop in the age between 18 to 20 as well. So like these measures have been shown to be effective in decreasing smoking rates in these age groups. So certainly, there is evidence that backs up that is a worthwhile legislation. I mean, the other thing to say is it's obviously a popular measure as well. Like two surveys which have been published over the last 2 years show that over 70% of people surveyed in Ireland support the measure. So it's an effective mm-hmm. measure. There's evidence there from other countries, and also it's popular. And the other thing to say is, we would be the first country in Europe to introduce this measure. So we would be taking the lead in tobacco control, which is something we've been calling for before, that Ireland really needs to up their game. Whereas in previous years we would have been, at the forefront of doing introducing brave measures. Now this would be certainly a brave measure, and we would be the first country in Europe.
And you said that the decline in tobacco consumption amongst Irish teenagers has stalled in the last number of years. Do we know why that's happening?
So sorry, just it's actually actually across the board, our tobacco rates in Ireland are stuck at 18%, and they have been since 2021. And so, you know, with that, you know, if you look at the ESPAD survey, which surveyed 16-year-olds, it also showed that the great progress we've been making with tobacco rates in this country has stalled as well. And there was actually a slight uptick in the number of teenage boys using cigarettes. So it's not only just teenagers, it's also adults. Smoking rates haven't decreased over the last number of years. It's probably multifactorial. Like, if you could argue that we haven't introduced much in the way of tobacco control legislation over the last 5 years. I know we've done great things in the past, but more recently we haven't really been proactive in that in the field of tobacco control. And also, you know, as I've spoken before, there has been an increase in vaping, and vaping teenagers are vape 3 to 5 times more likely to take up tobacco smoking. So that could be feeding into as well. But it probably is multifactorial, and there's a number of factors that are probably contributing to that stalling of tobacco mm-hmm. rates in this country.
And what age do children try cigarettes?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, they could be as young as, you know, 10, 11, 12, but the average age is somewhere, depending on what research you read, is between 14 to 16. And this type of measure will increase the age of initiation again, so it'll push it up further. And then, again, as I mentioned, the research shows that if you do that, it makes the harmful effects of tobacco less likely down the track. So, you know, we know by from research as well that the adolescent brain and young adult brain actually is still developing. So it's really vulnerable to the effects of nicotine. So if we can try and get people to young adults to not take up this harmful habit early in life, it would really benefit everyone down the track. And as you said, you know, nobody wants to have young people start smoking. There are teenagers. Everyone would agree with that. And I think it's a very sensible measure that the government is proposing, and a really worthwhile measure that hopefully will be effective.
All right.
Professor Des Cox, consultant in paediatric respiratory medicine at Crumlin Children's Hospital, talking to Claire Byrne this morning about the government's plans to raise the legal smoking age from 18 to 21. There's a portal, you may have heard, between Dublin and New York. It's a video screen with no sound, so think of it as being on a muted Zoom call with the Big Apple. And on this afternoon's Live Line, Joe Duffy lamented the fact that, as he put it, Dublin has disgraced itself again. Joe spoke to Irishman in New York, Bill Ardiff.
If you've read this article in the New York Post in the last few hours.
I have indeed. Good morning, Joe. How are you?
Good. I'm good, thanks. But it's saying, I'm ashamed of what's happening, because it's saying over the weekend in Dublin city centre, and remember, because of the time difference, it's much later. It can be 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, Saturday night, Sunday morning, and still 7 or 8 o'clock in Saturday evening in New York. So apparently on Saturday night, a number of people who were drunk or pretending to take cocaine in Talbot Street stood in front of the screen. They held up their phones, which had pornographic videos on it. They then, in a disgusting display, held up photos of the Twin Towers in flames on 9/11, which was a horrific, horrific event. They showed their bare arses. They showed swastikas. This is in Talbot Street in Dublin. It was installed on May the 8th, both in Manhattan and Dublin. Apparently, one young, very drunk woman was led away by Gardaí. I don't know who's supposed to police this video, by the way. She grinded her backside against the screen, and she was there for 20 minutes, according to one eyewitness. This woman was there for 20 minutes, very drunk, and slapping and grinding against the portal before the Gardaí stepped in. Now, the Gardaí might say, what role have we got? She was very drunk. Another video posted of what was happening down at the live portal showed people with swastikas, as I said, people with images and recordings of 9/11. And this, by the way, I presume, Bill, even looking at it from this side, to put up a recording of 9/11 and to be dancing around it in Talbot Street in Dublin in a joyful way would be upsetting to New Yorkers.
Oh, absolutely would be, Joe. No doubt about it. It's a shame. I mean, that someone, they put in this installation and then it kind of gets abused, you know? I'm sure there's a lot of good things going on about it, but unfortunately, it's the bad stuff that makes the headlines all the time, I suppose, right?
Yeah, and I see the New York Post.
Yeah.
They have one comment in the piece from a Catherine Doran, and she said the portal's location, close to Talbot Street in the north inner city, is unfortunate because she said it's a home to a lot of antisocial behaviour. There's lots of drugs in the area, a lot of homelessness, all the bars, all the clubs. When they're coming out, it's like, what are we going to do now? We're going to go to the portal and try and get a reaction. But you have to have a bit of sobriety into you to say, hang on a minute, let's show the New Yorkers images of 9/11. Let's get them up on our phone of the planes crashing into the Twin Towers and let's flash them. That is not drunken behaviour.
Yeah, no, that's definitely bad, and it's going to give the New Yorkers a bad impression of Irish people in general, and that'll spread, as always, bad news spreads faster than good news, unfortunately. But maybe if they put it up in Phoenix Park or Grafton Street, it might have, you know, a different kind of clientele going in front of it, you know. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I wonder. But also, the time difference, I wonder, did they take into consideration the time difference between Dublin and New York? We're 5-6 hours ahead, depending on the time of year.
Right, yeah.
So midnight, 1 o'clock, Saturday night, Sunday morning, Friday night, Saturday morning is a busy time, 6 o'clock in New York. And but it means it's a time, if people are going to have a few drinks, well, there they are standing. And swastikas. I don't know what the swastika thing. Now, as you know, Bill, at the minute, because of Gaza and what's happening in the Middle East, and the perception of Joe Biden and America in supplying arms to the Israelis, the American image generally is not great in Ireland at the minute, and that seems to be impacting on the portal as well.
Yeah. Well, like I say, I mean, if you open these things, Joe, and it's open to the public, and it's art and all the rest, and, you know, art is how you interpret it, as they say, but at the same time, when they start doing, images of swastikas and the towers burning and rubbing their arse against us, you know, that's definitely can't be interpreted too many different ways, you know.
Yeah. I just wonder. I don't know what you heard, because it was featured a lot last week in different, positively, because it was regarded positively. But they exist in Lithuania, Poland, and New York, and now Dublin. But it looks like the Dublin one is either going to have to be abandoned or time limited, which would be awful. In other words, you can't just say we'll put it on between 12 and 1 o'clock lunchtime every day, because that's 7-8 o'clock in the morning in New York. But anyway, Bill, how long are you in New York?
I'm over here since 1985, Joe.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you never lost the accent. You never lost the accent.
No. By the way,
tell us, how is the New York Post, which has just put up this article about the portal in Dublin, and the headline is Dublin live video art installation already bringing out the worst in people with lewd displays. So it's not nice about Ireland, to say the least.
Definitely not. It's that's very negative, you know. And like you say, the way the Irish people are feeling about Joe Biden now doesn't help the situation, you know. It's a shame.
It is a shame. Yeah, I just wonder what the Lord Mayor of Dublin, because the Dublin City Council had to put it up. It has to be powered. It has to get permission. I wonder what the Lord Mayor of Dublin thinks of this.
The joys of public art, eh? This is why we can't have nice things, Dublin. Joe Duffy talking to Irishman in New York, Bill Ardiff, about the Dublin New York Portal art installation on this afternoon's Live Line. Orla Doherty is an accidental comedian, but before that, she was a really good squash player. She joined Oliver Callan this morning to talk about her remarkable journey from squash player to stand-up comic via many different jobs.
I suppose all my life I'd suffered with depression a little bit. I was also quite a very, I suppose, roller coaster emotions. I was very moody, up and down, all over the place. And I was diagnosed in 2000 with bipolar disorder. And I do, when I do stand up, I do a little joke where I say, you know, I tell the doctor, "Doctor, I'm not bipolar at all. I'm Irish." You know, because I think all of us have a bit of something, right? So that's my standing joke. But I was on medication. I was in over the course of 12 years.
This is in America, obviously.
In America, yes.
It's the first protocol, isn't it?
I know. And at the time in Ireland, this was what year? 2000. So even in Ireland then, it was a bit taboo. You wouldn't sort of discuss mental health or...
Wouldn't have known what that was.
Talk about... Yeah, like my parents didn't understand what bipolar meant. It's manic depression, basically. So it's, you know, both emotions, highs and lows. And I kind of had depression more steadily. And the highs kind of came randomly, sort of, you know, maybe two a year. And that's when I would be, I was admitted five different times, and I'm laughing. I shouldn't laugh, but I use humour to kind of get through my...
What else can you do?
I know, you have to laugh. Yeah. Excuse me. So some good stories for being on the inside, I say.
The inside where? What are you
like the inside of the psychiatric wards.
Psychiatric wards and hospitals. So it was very, very serious.
It was a very serious thing. Yeah. And I was in with a lot of, God love them, very sick people. One guy, I remember having a conversation, and he was convinced I had a third eye, but you just kind of muzzle in. And I started a table tennis league in one of the hospitals I was in, and the doctors used to always say how upbeat I was whenever I was brought in. I was always generally brought in for depression, but then I suppose maybe I was dying to get out because, you know, you're kind of on your best behaviour. But I was put on loads of medication for, you know, lithium, antidepressants, antipsychotics.
How were you responding to that?
Well, initially, I suppose it helped stabilise my moods because I definitely would go from highs to lows quite regularly. But I realised after about 10 years, they were numbing my personality.
Right.
And I kind of became a bit flat, didn't enjoy going out. And I write in my memoir how I couldn't hear the birds singing. I couldn't smell things. I couldn't feel things. So when I lived in Santa Barbara, went to my doctor, Dr. Polo, and asked him if there was a way that I could just slowly taper off and maybe just try and find a way. Because it is possible to, you know, I think there's medication that many people need, and I'm not against it, but there's also ways, you know, through cognitive behavioral therapy and just having a good support system around you to kind of manage. And I did, thankfully, 9 years ago. It took me 9 months to taper very, very slowly off these drugs because you can't go cold turkey. It's very dangerous.
Yeah.
So I'm now medication free.
Oh, really?
And I feel like I have my spark back. I also think because I'm over 50, I'm more comfortable in my own skin.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, I've stopped drinking the hard stuff. I don't know, I'm more courageous. I think I was a bit of a people pleaser, and a lot of Irish people are people pleasers, you know.
We are, yeah.
And I won't use the F word, but I don't really give a...
You don't give a damn.
No, a damn. I mean, I do, obviously I care, but I'm not so much worried about what people think, and, you know, I just sort of get on with things and try, you know, we're also lucky to be here. People sometimes don't make it past 50, so
I know.
I'm going for it.
I know. You look great.
Do I?
Anyway. Yeah, you look fantastic.
Yeah,
and you said you don't drink. But you look don't drink.
No,
oh, you
I do
Oh, you just...
Just not the hard stuff.
Oh, really?
I love a glass of Prosecco.
So it worked for you coming off medication. So it was CBT, cognitive behavioural therapy, worked for
and,
you.
And, you know, and there...
You Have know, you been to... psych ward since
not
changed.
Since
oh,
no
really? Okay.
Thankfully so I moved back to Ireland in 2015 and
year as we
wasn't
discussed
it? I know. Perfect year. And I purposely didn't tell my doctor in Dublin, she's probably listening in now, that I had been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. I didn't tell anybody because it still felt it was a bit taboo in Ireland.
Mm. Really? You know? Even then?
And that's only what 10 yeah, 9 years
nine
ago.
Years ago.
But it's all out there now.
What caused you to be admitted to a psychiatric hospital?
Well, I mean, various things. The first time I was, I'm smiling here, I was up dancing up on a table in a bar and doing a little ABBA routine, actually, to Dancing Queen. That's my thing.
Yeah.
And was taken down and thrown out into the snow. It was a lovely December snowy night. And I took my clothes off and just did a snow angel, because who wouldn't?
Right. It was all going so, well up to
Everything
that point.
Everything was going so well. So anyway, and that's sort of the funny side of it. But I was brought in mostly for depression. I did have...
So were you kind of lifted from the street by...
Yeah, I had lovely hot paramedics.
Oh, paramedics.
Yeah.
And then you end up...
Into the ambulance. I've been in an ambulance several times.
So are you in a psychiatric hospital against your will at the time? Or
No, I think I was almost welcoming it because every
you
time I was brought in, I kind of had this build-up of... I need to kind of get myself together. So I never resisted it, but I was always dying. I think the longest I was ever in was 10 or 12 days. I was normally in 5 or 7 days. And You know, it was just kind of a...
It might sound short to us, but I presume to you at the time it's, it feels forever.
Yeah, yeah. And especially you have some interesting roommates. One woman thought I was trying to kill her because she kept passing gas in the middle of the night, so I just sprayed a bit of perfume. And she had called in the doctor saying, this woman is trying to suffocate me with her perfume. And, you know, lots of little interesting stories there.
People just very unwell, obviously. That's
very
why
unwell,
they're there.
Yeah. Lovely people, though.
I feel like... that if you did that in Ireland, the kind of nude snow angel thing, you wouldn't be picked up at the street by a paramedic and put in a...
No, you'd probably just
psychiatric
be
ward.
Given another can of Heineken and sent on your way, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you probably, I think you would, honestly. And the other times, did you...
Mostly for depression. I once had attempted suicide. Okay. This was in Philadelphia, shortly after my dad died. I took that very badly. Yeah. And I was very close to him. And that was sort of my... wife at the time called and said, you know, because I'd overdosed on Ativan, which is many people might know, Ativan is just an antidepressant. It's like an anxiety pill, but I'd taken too many of them. And to be honest with you, I don't think I wanted to die. I think I just needed help, you know, so I probably didn't take enough to kill myself. But I, you know, you have that feeling, and I wrote the letter, and it was just a very dark, dark time. But I've since sort of...
You were unwell. Lucky. You were unwell.
Oh, yeah. It's more common than we think.
That's what happens. Yeah. It's unwellness. We know now. We have the vocabulary, don't we?
Exactly.
It's improving bit by bit.
Yeah.
So,
and there's no shame in it.
Hearing how bad it got, it's fantastic that you are well.
I know. I'm very blessed. I'm lucky. I think when I came back to Ireland, I made it a mission. I moved back because people were dying. Basically, as we age, my relatives were dying, my aunt was dying, and I just wanted to be close to my family, which is what really got me to come back. But then I decided I'm going to start playing squash at a competitive level again.
Yeah.
And I was 48 years old, and I was coaching away, and I just decided, I never, believe it or not, had never actually played for Ireland as a senior player, which is over 18 up to 35. I'd always played junior,
right,
international,
yes,
squash. Hadn't
played senior.
But when I became pro at the age of 19, the Irish teams had been picked, and I was travelling around the world. So I got to be number 69 in the world as a professional, but never been selected on the Irish national team. So I said, Asher, look, I'm 48, I'll give it a go. So I did, sure enough.
And
I trained really hard. Oh my God, the training I put into it. But it was very good for my mental health, I have to say. I became a personal trainer, a fitness instructor. I was a spin instructor. I kind of went mad, and I suppose that's my personality. I'm either all or nothing. So nice. I went mad in the gym, and played all the provincial tournaments, Munster, Leinster, Ulster, and I got selected in the Irish team when I was 48. I know, and my teammates were half my age. Yeah. So that was just, I was delighted with myself. That was sort
what
of
a goal to achieve.
I know.
After all of that.
I know. And then 48. The same year I won the European Masters Championships.
Mm. So you weren't just managing to get into the team at that level, you were actually winning.
I know. That's, imagine.
Very proud of yourself.
Well, I mean, yeah.
No, you deserve. You deserve to take that. We're not good in Ireland. See, maybe the years in America you were kind of,
it's like,
allow yourself to clap yourself in the back the odd time.
Yeah, but you don't in Ireland. You say, oh, stop.
Yeah, you can't take compliments.
That's squash player, coach, turned stand-up comic Orla Doherty talking to Oliver Callan this morning. As you may have noticed, there's been a bit of rain about in 2024. And we heard on Today with Clare Byrne this morning, this wetter than usual spring will result in poor crops for some varieties of Irish potato, including the ever popular Kerr's Pinks. Clare spoke to Killarney grocer Dan Horan about what's turning into a shortage for his customers.
First of all, let me explain. Kerry, Cork, Tipperary were very popular counties for Kerr's Pinks. Now, up the Midlands and up where you live in Dublin and all that side, it's mostly roosters. About 70% in Dublin, I think, are potatoes are roosters. If we go up the west coast, is the potato called Records, Limerick, Galway and Tyre. But down here with us, it is virtually about 90% are Kerr Pinks.
Mm-hmm.
But normally Kerr Pinks, Clare, go last with us until about mid-July. That's normally, the last few years, there was quite a good supply. And there's also another potato called Golden Wonders, which is a very dry potato as well, but very popular this time of the year as well. But both of them have completely dried up.
Gone.
So we're about, we're there, yeah. There's a small sprinkle around. You might still get the odd bag here and there, but the quality is basically gone very poor on them. We got in a few ourselves last Friday, but we're not standing over the quality anymore. It's the end of the line, really, for that for them this year. And so we're about at least two months shaft of what we would normally have. And a lot of people don't like the new potatoes that come in. We'll start coming in from this week on, the new season of pinks, or sorry, queens, and so on, and premiers are caught. They still like the old potatoes, and unfortunately, we have a potato called Mackie's, which I had on that video that you watched.
I saw them,
Yeah, now, look, I'm not pushed about potatoes myself. I'm happy with roosters, with anything, but a lot of people are just caught up in keeping down here with us. And, you know, the alternatives don't like it. But, look, it is the best that we have. We are telling people, look, it is a difficult year because of the bad weather last year, when I think some of the potatoes weren't able to be dug out of the ground. And this year, we're a month behind in the news, in the planting of the new season. So it is a difficult year, and we're trying to tell people, you've got to live with us, and we will get through it.
Can I talk to you about the different potatoes? Because you mentioned Golden Wonders there, and you said that they're a dry potato. We would call them a flowery potato.
Is
the Kerr Pinks, would you describe that as a sort of a soapy potato?
No, they're not soapy, but they're not maybe quite as dry as Wonders. Wonders, for some people, actually, they don't like them for the simple reason they're too floury.
Yeah, you need a lot of butter.
Yes. Yeah, Pinks wouldn't be quite at that level at all. And they're slightly different taste to the Wonders again, but they're both very, very popular. I think Wonders all over the country. Pinks are very much down here in these counties down here close to me. But they're both hugely popular potatoes. We could sell at least about 200 bags of Pinks in a week between two shops here in Tralee and Killarney. We do about 60 or 70 bags of Golden Wonders normally a week as well. So that has completely dried up now for us, unfortunately.
But you have the Mackies, and do people like the Mackies?
Yeah, look, they're putting up with it. They're not that first choice, of course. But look, they are. At least, look, we buy them in the shops. We show people what they're like before they buy them. And they said, look, they're okay. They're okay. The other alternative would be roosters. We have them as well, of course. But the Mackies, they're putting up with them. We don't have any choice, I suppose, for the next couple of months, unfortunately, because so the new season has gone behind as well, which is making it more difficult as well.
Okay. And would you expect the Kerr Pinks to be back then into September, August time?
They're normally back in the middle of August again. That's the new season, comes in the middle of August. And then they'll be in full swing then by September again. But it'll depend again on the weather and how the year plans out for the growers. And will they be able to dig them again when the fall of the year and so on. So an awful lot depends on the weather, unfortunately.
So when you say you haven't seen it as bad in 35 years, you're talking about the weather, and that's what has led to this problem.
I mean, both the weather and the shafted. We've never before been shafted Pinks this time of the year. Or the Golden Wonders either. So it's my first time to have no Pinks for the next 2 months. That's new for me.
And that's the weather, is it?
The weather has led us both to the shortage of the Pinks and the Golden Wonders. What's new for me is to have no Pinks in my shop in the month of May and June, basically.
So we have the bad rain, as we have seen, but also there's been a big reduction in the number of growers in recent years, hasn't there?
Oh yeah, there has. Now look, I don't like the fact, but look, you know, I've had to watch the multiples, drive down the price of fruit and veg over the years. That they use it as a loss leader. I worked for one of them one time, and I know exactly what they do. They use it as a loss leader to get drying customers. But the consequence of that, of course, is the growers are suffering. They don't get the price they should be getting, and a lot of them have given up growing as the citizens
don't
want it anymore.
Dan Horan from Horan's Health Stores in Killarney, talking to Claire Byrne this morning about how our wet start to the year has led to a shortage of Kerr Pinks potatoes in the shops. Gone are the days in Ireland when a salad meant a slice of ham, some iceberg lettuce, a hard-boiled egg and some salad cream on the side. Salads have got altogether more exotic and much more flavoursome, and thank goodness for that. On this afternoon's Ray Darcy Show, Ray was joined by Theo Kerwin, co-founder of Sprout & Co. Restaurants and the author of new cookbook Saladology.
Now, people may not know you, but they know your shop, Sprout.
Yeah.
And I see that you've just sprouted a seventh one. They're mainly in Dublin, are they?
Yeah, we have six restaurants in Dublin and we have one restaurant in Kildare Village as well.
Right. And it's you and your brother?
Yeah, Jack.
Jack. And Jack is really the... Originally, he was the chef as a kid. And he sort of roped you in as a commie chef.
I was his commie, so we joked when we were kids. Jack did the cooking and I did the chopping.
Right.
Naturally, he delegated the worst jobs to me as his little brother. But we're both just madly passionate about food from a very young age. Come from quite a foodie family. Always had big salads on the table growing up. We all knew how to make French dressing,
So, from what age were you preparing meals?
Probably from about 11 on.
Right.
Well, not every dinner. Mum was a great cook, but she just encouraged us to be experimental and adventurous with food. So we, took over big family occasions. She led us at it to try and test things out.
Yeah. So then you were going to be an actor.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. How did that work out for you?
I had a lot of fun doing it.
Yeah.
I studied drama and had a lot of fun doing it. And then my brother started this juice business called Sprout about 8 or 9 years ago, or longer, 10 years ago, and wanted help. So he called me up and said, "Will you jump in and help support me?"
Yeah.
And I never really looked back since.
And the juice went from. On to salads.
When you're 22, which my brother always wanted to open a restaurant, it's very hard to get backing. So the juice business was our way to prove ourselves.
Right.
And then later on, someone backed us to open our first restaurant on Dawson Street. So since then, we've gone on to open the six restaurants. In our third year, we started our own organic farm where we grow a lot of our own salad leaf for the restaurants.
Yeah, so when you go in, I don't know if anybody, well, some people obviously have been in your shops, they call them restaurants, I suppose, but you have a wall of salad leaves.
Yeah, with big displays of all the greens and all the vegetables.
And they all come from your farm in Kildare?
Well, as much as we can, we grow everything outdoors. At the moment, in about 5 weeks, we'll have lots of ingredients coming, lots of the leaf coming from the farm. About 10 months of the year, we have kale, curly kale available, and the rest of the growing season is about 8 to 9 months.
Right.
So when we can't, we can source from other Irish growers, but we try to do it when we can.
And it's fresh. I remember being in New York in the 90s, and you go in and you get a bowl and there's a basic number of leaves at the bottom, then you just fill it up around the place. And that's basically what you do, although it's not DIY.
Well, I heard you're a Sprout fan.
Yeah. Well, I've been in there. Whenever I go into town, I try to go to Sprout. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're all about, we make salads and warm bowls, but it's healthy food, but we're all about flavour first. So, we try to make it fun and exciting and lots of, crunchy things.
Yeah.
And I've got a couple of salads here if you want to try some of them.
I will. The book, I earmarked a few ones that caught my attention.
Okay.
The one is the one with the anchovies and the tomato on the bread. That looks delicious.
Yeah,
what's that one called?
That's called tomato and bread salad.
A
play on panzanella, which is a classic Italian salad where they basically had all the glut of tomatoes that they had left over and stale bread. You basically salt the tomatoes really generously so they create a nice tomatoey juice, and then you tear stale bread and chuck it in with the tomato juice and lots of other ingredients.
So no waste, because the sourdough on day four, day five, Wednesday.
It has a lovely texture because it kind of goes chewy and soft. So it's a great, really simple salad. I would make that for my family every summer.
Right, so that's basil leaves, red onion, anchovies,
bread, garlic.
And tomatoes.
Yeah.
Are tomatoes in season now?
I've got some Irish tomatoes in
this
salad.
Great.
So yeah, that's something I always get excited about. I heard you earlier talking about strawberries in winter tasting like cardboard. I think with tomatoes, when they come into season in Ireland, they've got that really great burst of sweetness.
As they should taste.
Should have that sweetness. So I always grab them and use them when I can.
I was trying to make the crispy the crispy fish last night, but when I went down to the supermarket, all the main ingredients were sold out.
The fish finger salad?
No, it's the one with the I'd made the dressing, which has lime and oyster sauce and chilies and where is that one now? Do you know the one I'm talking about?
Go right to the back where the fish is.
Ah, yes.
I'm trying to remember. There's over 100 recipes in there.
There it is there. Crispy Thai style fish salad. That's delicious. So,
did you make the dressing?
I did.
With the fish sauce?
Yes. It's really lovely.
It's delicious.
Yeah. So simple as well.
Yeah. So spicy, punchy.
Yeah. So there's lime, fish sauce, garlic and chilies.
Yeah.
Thinly sliced. All mixed up. That's so straightforward and so delicious.
Mm. It's kind of the balance of the salty fish sauce and the spiciness and then a little bit of sweetness.
Yeah,
I use that dressing for so many different salads. So within the book, I think I've used that dressing with a couple of other ideas. So you have, I hope people will get the tools to kind of experiment with, you know, you make one dressing and then learn to go, okay, well, I'll pair that with tomatoes or I'll pair that with a crispy fish finger.
Yeah, and you have all the, at the back, you've all the various things that will add dressings, crispy things and pickles. So if you have those and you make a few of those, they'll add to your salad.
So yeah, in Sprite, we've been going for 8 years in the restaurant. So within the book, I picked some of our most popular dishes, our classics, and then that larder of all the flavour boosters that kind of make eating salads really, really delicious. We've included all that.
And so, what is your most popular salad?
I brought two of them.
Right,
so,
great. You see?
I'll start with our most popular salad, which is called our paprika chica. And basically, my mum created this dip when we were kids called Mum's Spanish Dip, and it's a really garlicky, smoky paprika yogurt, and it kind of got us all really excited about dipping vegetables into it and eating it, so we developed it into our most popular salad, and the paprika chica.
Right.
Well, I pass it over.
Yeah, and your mum gets a percentage, does she, of all the takings?
Well, she gets a lot of credit for it, and I started a series for Sprout called Stop Giving Away Our Secrets, where we have started giving away our secrets. So Mum's recipe is on our Instagram page if you want to go and find it. And it's also in the
book. What's your mum's name?
Siobhan.
Siobhan, that's delicious. Yeah. I'm going to go straight to Siobhan. No, thank you.
Well done, Mum.
Yeah. And your sweet potatoes there.
So the salad is chicken, rice, organic spinach, chili, spring onion. It's very simple. And then it's a mustardy French dressing. So yeah. Classic flavours, and then Mum's very delicious, addictive sauce on top.
And the brilliant thing about all those things is they don't stay with you. You feel full, but you don't feel sort of as you do
with... Lethargic.
Yes.
Okay, well, this next one, if I can open this tub, is called...
Saladology is the book, Theo Kerwin. So how come you got to write the book and Jack didn't? Or what's the divvying out of jobs?
Well, Jack is more the... I'd say maybe the more entrepreneurial business head. I'm more on the creative side.
Uh-huh.
So Jack has the much more stressful job than me. I'm in the kitchen developing our next menus and all that sort of stuff. So, and really online telling the story.
And this one is?
That's our Satisfied chicken bowl.
So this is satay chicken.
Satay chicken that has been... By far, that's been our menu since day one and is always our top-selling dish.
Some mouth-watering fare that Lucky Ray got to taste in studio this afternoon from Sprout & Co. co-founder and author Theo Kerwin. Theo's book, Saladology, is published by Mitchell Beasley. Finally on this edition of Playback Daily...
Monday, so good to me. Monday morning, it was all I hoped it would be.
That's the Mamas and the Papas with Monday Monday, a pop song that references a weekday, which is the hook Claire Byrne and founder of 8radio.com Simon Marr used for their musical item This Morning. Here's Simon on Monday Monday.
I think what I really like about it so much is that it manages to be all sort of nice and gentle and mellow, but at the same time it talks about the fact you can't trust Mondays, right? And it's right. It's completely, completely right, but without doing it in that real maudlin way that so many of us feel on a Monday morning. You know, it does it beautifully, but it does, yeah, lets you know,
gently,
don't trust a Monday.
Gently gets you through it.
Absolutely, absolutely. We'll take that.
But you can't mention Mondays without a blast of this.
Just another man. Money.
Yeah, I prefer that. Get you through, upbeat, the Bangles.
Do you know, I'll tell you what, things I love. I love the Bangles. You know, they let there be no
secret.
Yeah, there let there be no secret about this. But one of the things that Manic Monday does brilliantly is it does the comparison between days thing. Is that Mondays are bad and I really, really don't like Mondays. And it's just because other days are so good. Because Susanna Hoffs is talking all about how she wishes it was Sunday. That's my fun day. And it's always going to be about that. So you can talk about a song about it being, I suppose, mourning for the day that's been, mm-hmm. or a day that's really just killing time till you get to the day that you want.
Yeah, but
for anticipation.
She never experienced watching Glen Rowe, knowing that she hadn't done your homework.
She didn't. It was not bath night for Susanna Hoffs on a Sunday night once Glen Rowe came on.
Now, we have, of course, the Boomtown Rats as well. I don't like Mondays. Does that qualify in this little look at our days and our titles?
It'll qualify in here, but it's one of the few songs, I suppose, that references a specific day. So that's the thing. So it was a story that the Boomtown Rats were doing a radio interview in Atlanta, and there was a telex machine. This will show you how long ago this story came out. But the story came out of Breda Ann Spencer, who was involved in a school shooting back in those days. And when she was asked why she did it, she just said, "I just don't like Mondays." Mm-hmm. So it's a song that's about a very specific Monday, but it's a very, very powerful tune too.
There's Blue Monday by New Order.
Yeah.
But that is unusual because...
because it never mentions Blue Monday. It never mentions Monday at all. It's all about mood. And that's the thing. You can do it really well. And in fairness, New Order do that better than most bands. And they love that. They love a bit of writing songs that never, never reference anything. And even the album cover, the 12-inch cover of the song when it came out, you know, there's no reference of either song nor nor band on it at all. But Blue Monday is all about the mood. But it works so well on so many levels.
Okay, Monday, done. Close the door on that. Let's go to Tuesday.
The week's getting better.
Tuesday morning from the Pogues, and you're right, we're feeling better now, aren't we?
We are, and even though they say apparently psychologically Tuesday is the worst day of the week, right? So whenever they talk about this, they put this for Spider in the Pogues. It was that stage. We're in the post Shane McGowan era now at this stage, where the period of the Pogues' existence where Shane McGowan is not there. They released this song, and this is all about anticipation again. He loves Monday because Monday gives him the promise of what comes on Tuesday. You know, that's what he's after.
What's coming on Tuesday?
He's after the love that Tuesday brings in his life. And
he has an appointment.
He does have an appointment on a regular basis on a Tuesday, but it means Monday. So he says his favourite time of the week is actually Monday evening. It's just as good, if not better, than the anticipation of what Tuesday might bring.
Okay, hump day now. It's Wednesday.
I can hear the soft breathing of a girl that I love. As she lies here beside me, asleep with the night, and her hair in a fine mist floats on my pillow, reflecting the glow of the winter moonlight.
Does that not sound a bit creepy to you?
Yeah, a little bit.
But
we're going to allow him. We're going to allow Simon and Garfunkel on this one because of the fact that they know that it's all lovely at the minute, but it's all going to go horribly, horribly wrong. He's there. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. He's lying beside his love. Everything is fine. And it's only as the song goes on that you realise, oh, this is not going to be a good Wednesday for your art. It's not really going to go well for you at all. Because he had previously, during this Tuesday evening, he had done over an off-licence. And now he knows that on Wednesday morning, he's going to have to go to the police.
Okay.
So he's lying there awake and going, look at all I have, look what I've done, and look what awaits me. So for as hump days go, it's as bad as it gets for Simon Garfunkel.
Sounds like he might be one of Marion Keyes' feathery strokers that she was talking to Oliver about last week.
I think so.
Lots of suggestions coming in. I was hoping for Ruby Tuesday, says Joe, and another listener too.
Yeah, yeah, that's fair enough. That's absolutely fair enough. And that's one of those. There's only a few songs that are out there that are named after a person with a J in their name.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that doesn't qualify, does it?
Well,
you've got rules here.
I have no rules. I'm utterly corruptible on this. So I'll take it. So no, Ruby Tuesday is a great song.
All right. Well, look, we're looking up now. We've gone past Wednesday and we're into Thursday. Only for you. No, I wanted him to be happier on Thursday, David Bowie with Thursday's Child.
I think that's kind of as happy as Bowie gets. I think that is happy Bowie, like, you know. I think he's good with all of this. He had read Eartha Kitt's autobiography, which is all about Thursday's Child. So Thursday's Child being full of grace and all that, and he was inspired by that. But it got us into a conversation then about what day of the week that you were born. Apparently, for some people, this is a huge deal. I still don't know, Claire.
I don't know either. Yeah, I could find out.
Yeah, but David Bowie was Thursday's Child, as was Eartha Kitt.
We could all find out, couldn't we? And then we'd have to adopt a song.
That's the thing. But that's where Bowie got that from anyway.
So Thursday, other Thursday-inspired tracks, Simon.
See, I'm back to it again. This is how you explain this on a Monday morning. So Morphine have a great tune, which is called Thursday. And it's again, we're back to, it's like the Pogues Tuesday morning.
Another appointment.
It so happens that this man has an appointment with a married lady, but every Thursday afternoon, because the married lady's husband is out of town on a Thursday, but he changes his habits. And so Thursday becomes what was something that was a great day and a great appointment for him starts to go horribly wrong.
Okay. So Thursday, not a great day.
I'm just glad I managed to explain that one.
He did. Out the gap. Right. We're on to Friday then. Let's have a listen.
With Friday I'm in Love from Simon Marr's tribute to songs that reference days of the week on this morning's Today with Claire Byrne. And that's all I have for you on this edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Sheridan. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio app. I'll be back with another catch-up-a-rama tomorrow. Until then, thank you for listening and good luck.